This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 13th of April 2024. I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. Coming up on today's programme, we'll have a look through the week's news and culture with Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow at Chatham House. Then...
The Italian summit climbers became famous, not just in Italy, but around the world, for making the first ascent of K2. Amir Mehdi spent the rest of his life living in obscurity and pain.
Monocle correspondent Greg Scruggs sits down with the author Bernadette McDonald, who shines a spotlight on Himalayan climbers like Amir Mehdi. First, though, here's the news. Israel is braced for an attack by Iran or its proxies, as warnings grow of retaliation for last week's killing of a senior officer in Iran's embassy in Damascus. Countries including India, France, Poland and Russia have warned their citizens against travel to the region, whilst US President Joe Biden says he expects Iran to attack Israel sooner rather than later and warned Tehran not to proceed. A cooperation agreement by the Philippines, the United States and Japan after their first trilateral summit will change the dynamic in the South China Sea and the region, Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. said, while seeking to assure China it was not a target. Beijing has summoned Manila's ambassador to the country and a Japanese embassy official to oppose what its foreign ministry described as negative comments against China. And Italian fashion designer Roberto Cavalli, known for his animal print designs, has died at the age of 83. Cavalli, who founded his label in the early 1970s, had been ill for some time. He's survived by his six children and his partner, and his funeral will be held in Florence on Monday. And that's your Monocle Radio News. Hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday. I'm Georgina Godwin and I'm joined in the studio by Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and a lecturer in International Relations at the University of Roehampton. Yossi, do you have any Cavalli in your wardrobe?
No.
But you know, he was well known for making jeans too, Cavalli's big denim brand. And we are going to be talking about jeans.
Yeah, I'm still sticking to the American style of it, less than the European one.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, we're going to be talking about is picking up on our lead story. And this is a story that we've been discussing all week here on our current affairs programmes, is will they, won't they? What is Iran going to do? They've come under attack. Most analysts are going... they are not going to launch a full-scale attack themselves on Israel, but there are so many think pieces about this. Today, the New York Times has a big piece. Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, also has a piece. What do we think?
Yeah, it's almost surreal, you know, that you're waiting for a war to take place. You think probably someone should prevent it because we know what are the consequences of something like this or potential consequence to that. But... even President Joe Biden talks about, you know, we expect it. And you say, if the President of the United States expects it, it must happen. Then he says, don't. Mm. So don't dare do that. And there is an ironclad support of Israel. I think while we are in the midst of the war in Gaza, there is also, for example, that there is a war between Israel and Iran, a conflict, and some level of violence between Israel and Iran that goes now for years. What Israel called war between wars, which try to reduce the threat that comes from Iran. So assassination, of course, we need also say allegedly by Israel, when their chief nuclear scientist was assassinated in Iran, when attack on computer. There are almost daily attacks in Syria, whether it's Iran's proxy Hezbollah or in Lebanon itself. But what happened last week, the attack in Damascus, in what seems to be an official mission, diplomatic mission, Iranian diplomatic mission, in Iran, killing two generals and some other Iranian seem of stepping up or escalating the situation, which Iran feels that it's obliged to retaliate. Now the question is timing, place and scope, because this is going to determine to a large extent the counter-retaliation. And at one point say, all right, you retaliated. If it said something that looked, and who knows what, is proportionate, so it won't lead to escalation. We said, all right, it's quit. If not, what's next? From Iran's point of view, it's Iran feels most comfortable using proxies. If they're going to change this and directly attack Israel, and then the question, is it going to be inside Israel proper? Is it, as some suggested, in the occupied Golan Heights? Is it some diplomatic mission abroad? Then there is a direct confrontation, and then already not only the United States, some European countries warned that this might lead to escalation and retaliation. So it's a very tense moment. I think it might be even a defining moment in the relation between Israel, Iran, probably the United States, but then how the region also reacts to this.
Particularly Saudi Arabia.
For instance, and if you look at Saudi Arabia, which probably had the smarter policy when it comes to Iran, they realized that the United States not going necessarily to defend it in case of an Iranian attack, as was the case when Iranian proxies attacked their oil installations. So they moved more into the diplomatic track and resumed diplomatic relations while China was the one that brokered it. But then what happens if it's become a confrontation and one of this, you know, need to take sides? What are the alliances? What are going to be alignments as a result of it? The only hope that if there is an Iranian attack, it's limited in scope and won't drag the entire region into what we call cascade war. On the other hand, the Iranian might play the long game, and they are very good at that. You know, talk to Iranians, we've been around for thousands of years, unlike the rest of you. We have time on our side. And you say, we keep you expecting something to happen, so we create now deterrence because you know that we can send drones, we can launch missiles, but we'll decide if we want to do it or not. Mm. And they might be better for it.
What about other alliances and basically joining the dots between our two major conflicts at the moment? So that's Russia's relationship with Iran.
Yeah, it's Russia and China. So what happened? In a way, we see almost the collapse of the post-1945 global security or collective security order. Obviously, the Security Council, that should be the main mechanism to prevent or stop wars, doesn't function. Even when, for instance, it reached a resolution about a ceasefire and the release of the hostages a few weeks ago, then immediately the United States say it's not binding, and we see there is still no ceasefire and no release of hostages. We are what some call the new Cold War. And in this, if this is a new Cold War, is it going to be as binary as the first Cold War? We don't know. But automatically, you look for allies. Those who will say, for instance, Russia needs drones, need other weapons. Ukraine on the other side looking for the West to support it. So it creates this room for alliances. The one that tried to avoid it is most of the Middle Eastern countries, that they know what might be the consequences. Bear in mind, between 1980 and 1988, the Iran-Iraq war exacted huge price from both sides. Do we really want to go back to something similar?
There is no question that the world is in an absolutely dire state at the moment. So I'm not quite sure why here in Britain we're examining whether one middle-aged woman did or didn't pay capital gains tax on her ex-council house.
Is this part of our island mentality? That's, you know, there was a famous thing, I can't remember who said it, someone, the forecast was there is a fog in the channel, the continent is isolated. So it seems to be like this, when everything goes wrong around the world, and, you know, we're in the silly season of before election. We can't even decide when elections are going to be held. And there are hints like this is the biggest state secret. Is it going to happen in October? Can we have election in January of 2025? In other words, when the Tories are actually going to lose the elections and we're going to have a Labour government. So it's a lot of it is to find why the other side is basically worse than the others, which obviously after 14 years of Tories, doing so much corruption, so scandals of this or the other, including one MP providing list of phone numbers, part of a honey trap. And so it's sometimes it's ridiculous. And probably most of the listeners said around the world ask, you know, when there are all this issue, Ukraine, we saw it this morning, the attack on Ukraine and power plants in Ukraine, and we are dealing with that. I think for the Tories, Angel Ryan, the deputy leader, the Labour deputy leader, is almost an easy target, an obvious target for them.
Mm. Let's just talk about what's happened to her. She, as you say, is the deputy leader of the Labour Party, was living with her husband in one home, had another home, which she sold. The tax laws say if it's not your primary home, you need to pay capital gains tax. Mm. She says she didn't know that. Then she says, oh, but she's actually not liable. It's all very grey about what is or isn't. But one thing she has said is if she has been proven to break the law, she will stand down.
Which I think is going to be a shame. Again, if you break the law, you break the law. But I think sometimes it's interesting for me that the first kind of all of this knowledge about this story about the flat came from in a book by one of the donors of the Tory party that was for tax reasons lived abroad and making many millions. And here, just to put it in perspective, we're talking about maximum £3,500 of tax. So in most cases, if this happens, probably the HMRC will fine you. You pay the £3,500 plus something. So it's not right, obviously, to break the law. But how many of us that are not accountants or lawyers know exactly how much you need to pay and whether you live part-time with your husband? I think for the Tories, the idea, especially Angela Ryan, because she is a working class, she's from Stockport, which is just outside Manchester, and because she became a mother at the age of 16. And she doesn't have what, for the Tories, is the kind of the family life that at least they claim to support. She's an easy target for them. It's a kind between snobbery and misogynism, which I'm happy that the Labour Party trying to push back as much as possible. And, it's honourable of her to say that she will resign and leave politics. I don't think this is a kind of an offence, even if an offence was committed, that she should leave politics. She's an important politician, and she represents something that is missing, definitely in the front benches in British politics. That's why they dislike it, which is a bit of a British understatement. Why they dislike her so much, and considering, you know, that including the Prime Minister, you know, legally avoiding tax, because they created the laws that they can avoid tax to the tune of millions a year, I think it's a bit rich coming from the Tories.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, but as we've established, really very honourable of her to say if she has been proven to have broken the law, she will stand down, unlike somebody who we know has broken the law and is running for president.
By the way, you see, the British Prime Minister actually broke the law during COVID.
Yes.
On something even more serious. It took Boris Johnson months no end for breaking the law and denying that there were parties, but most of us were, you know, sitting at home and meeting no one. And they concentrated on it. So I said there is a hint of hypocrisy there. Mm-hmm. But as you said, Trump, and he's becoming again, I mentioned the word surreal, but this is more than surreal, bizarre. If 2016 was bizarre, and the introduction of Donald Trump as a serious candidate to become president, we also no, he was not going to win the election. I think after 2016 we stopped saying never, because we had Brexit and we had Donald Trump winning elections, so we stopped. It would never happen. Mm. And here is even talking about himself, comparing himself to Nelson Mandela. Now, he is one of the greatest leaders of probably the greatest leader of the 20th century, and someone that's, you know, spent time in jail and came out of it and not looking for revenge and avenging, but tried to bring South Africa. Sadly, South Africa is not going exactly the direction that Nelson Mandela intended. And, well, Trump is involved with all this legal allegation, including hush money. And he compares himself to Nelson Mandela, and it led to Nelson Mandela's grandson to say, this is completely barmy. You can't compare. But there are even some posters that actually portray Trump as Jesus. So Mandela is, I think, in one of the articles that I read in the Washington Post, actually, forget about Mandela, if you can be Jesus in this sense. And as we know, many of the supporters of the Republicans are extremely religious. So if you equate Trump at this point to Jesus, it's even better. You definitely need to vote for him. But I think the next few months, I know it makes us, you know, chuckle about it, but at the same time, this is serious. If this is the kind of level of argumentation that we are going, when, again, the world is going completely now, we need serious leadership to deal with climate change and with artificial intelligence and wars and the challenge of China that I think we spoke about earlier this week, and bring these alliances and wars and human rights. And possibly the next president of the United States thinks he's Jesus, as we know that this is the beginning of a lot of trouble.
As the Washington Post puts it, his long walk to megalomania.
Yes.
You talked about AI there, and there's a great piece in The Economist about what humans will do if technology solves everything. What will we do? We'll find something to complain about, won't we?
Yeah, it's a new publication about what happens if there is AI. So there is a kind of the dystopian side of AI. We basically will ruin humanity, and that's the end of the world as we know it. And now there is a new publication called Deep Utopia, which is actually very positive, because AI is going to be so successful. So it will do all the jobs for us. It will do even parenting for us. So I'm not so sure this is utopia or dystopia if we stop actually doing all of this. Yeah. We're definitely not going to cook. We're not going to clean. And the idea that we'll generate wealth with zero cost. So basically, it's kind of the idea of paradise on Earth as a result of it. But what we are going to do then? So as you suggest, that we'll find something to do to complain, and this is not good and the other. One of the suggestions in this publication, there is something about our relative position in society. It's not enough that we have what we need. It's how it's in relations to others. Because think about, you know, when I read some the wealthiest people in the world, which is kind of wealth we can just imagine, probably can't even calculate. But they need more. They look for new advantage. Because it's not where they're the richest people in the world. They need to, you know, to it to be more than someone else. And in many ways, we think about in a lot of other things, why we need a new mobile phone, why we need a new car when they are functioning. It goes into that. So that's the question, what us as human being, because is AI going to change us as human being, which is not definitely not the good news, but our relation with this technology. And I think it's interesting because It's something's going to happen. AI is coming, is already here. And usually with technology, it moves much faster than the social discourse. So we are always few steps beyond, kind of more than few steps, many steps behind this. We saw it with social media. We never thought that social media, for instance, is going to change the political discourse in a way that it will affect election. Speaking about Trump, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So the same goes, and even more so, with AI. So we need to start thinking to have a social discourse that fits the technological one and the advancement. But either the political or the social discourse is usually the conversation. It's beyond, we get excited about all these gadgets, what they can do for us. But then so how it changes us. As, you know, as someone is teaching for many years, I see kind of, even before there were mobile phones, how it changes the kind of the dynamic in class.
Mm.
And it took so long. And now we go full circle from saying that at the beginning, banning phones, then say, no, it's a great tool to use in class. And then say, no, it's a great tool, but students are not using that for the purpose of it. So that's the kind of the challenges we are facing.
Absolutely. We're all struggling to climb the summit of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, high in the Himalayan mountains, Nepalese Sherpas are busy fixing ropes through dangerous glaciers as they prepare for another record session of attempts to climb Mount Everest. Well, these local climbers are the subject of a new book by Bernadette McDonald, founding vice president of Mountain Culture at the Banff Centre for Arts and Creativity and former director of the Banff Mountain Film and Book Festivals. In Alpine Rising, Sherpas, Balties and the Triumph of Local Climbers in the Greater Ranges, the Canadian author gives centre stage to the region's traditional inhabitants. Monocle's Seattle correspondent Gregory Scruggs recently sat down with McDonald and he began by asking her how local climbers are treated by Western explorers or how they were treated at the dawn of high-altitude mountaineering in the early 20th century.
When I was doing research for this book, I was reading accounts of expeditions who were coming to the high mountains as far back as the early 1900s. Most of these expeditions came from countries like England and France and Germany, and they were sponsored by their alpine clubs. So they would come through Darjeeling, they would hire local climbers to help them carry loads, break trails, set up camps, and at the end of the expedition, they would write a report for their sponsor. And in those reports, the individual foreign climbers were named, what happened on the mountain was described in great detail, but the local climbers were often not named at all. In fact, they were often just referred to as, you know, seven Sherpas or 10 porters or sometimes even coolies. So they were very underrepresented in those reports.
And yet, despite their anonymous treatment by their Western clients, they performed quite a number of heroic feats, sometimes even saving the lives of climbers who went on to get all of the glory. Tell me about some of those instances.
The efforts of these local climbers in those early expeditions were incredible. And one example was from a 1954 expedition to K2, second highest mountain in the world and often considered the most difficult of the 8,000 meter peaks. An Italian team came to climb K2. They had a big team and they had local climbers helping them. When the two summit climbers needed extra oxygen for their last summit push, one Italian climber and one local climber from Shimshal Valley of Pakistan, his name is Amir Mehdi, carried the oxygen to a high camp at 8,100 meters. Unfortunately, it was too late in the day by the time they delivered the oxygen, so they had to bivouac at 8,100 meters. As a result, Amir Mehdi lost all of the toes on his feet and half of one foot because his feet were stuffed into Italian army boots that were two sizes too small. The Italian summit climbers became famous, not just in Italy, but around the world for making the first ascent of K2. Amir Mehdi spent the rest of his life living in obscurity and pain and unable to support his family because he could no longer work.
And yet when historians refer back to the first successful climb of Mount Everest, both Sir Edmund Hillary of New Zealand and his local guide Tenzing Norgay are spoken of in the same breath. Was that the turning point for local climbers gaining recognition?
It's interesting to look at the first ascent of Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay because in that case, Tenzing Norgay did gain worldwide fame, and he is an anomaly in this historical progression. In fact, he was so famous that there were three countries fighting over him. Tibet, Nepal, and India all wanted to claim him as their citizen. But this is an unusual situation. Local climbers before and after Tenzing did not get that recognition. They did not get that fame, and they did not get the financial remuneration that he did.
So when and how did local climbers begin to assert their aspirations with their Western clients and even become partners on more equal footing on these expeditions?
Over time, local climbers gained a lot of experience and a lot of skills, and this helped them assert themselves with foreign climbers. For example, in 1975, when Sir Chris Bonington came to Nepal to attempt the southwest face of Everest, which had never been climbed, it's a very difficult face, he had local climbers working with him, including a man named Pertemba Sherpa. Well, Pertemba Sherpa was a very accomplished climber already, and when he agreed to work with Sir Chris Bonington, he made it clear that he expected a chance at the summit. And he got it. He was one of four people who climbed the southwest face of Everest. This was one of the turning points, I think, in this transition from poorly paid, unrecognized, brute labor to equal partner on a mountain.
Today, climbing 8,000-meter peaks in the Himalayas and the Karakoram, it's frankly become a big business. How have these local climbers taken advantage, if you will, of that economic opportunity? They're no longer the anonymous Sherpas they once were. What is their role today in the business of climbing?
As local climbers from Pakistan and Nepal have gained experience and skills, they have also gained some control over what goes on in the highest mountains in Asia, particularly Nepali climbers. But I think the big game changer for all of them has been the internet. The internet has allowed them to reach out to people, to tell their own stories, and to build their own businesses. They can now attract their own clients. They can hire their own guides. They have complete control over what's going on in the guiding world in the high mountains of Asia. And this is transforming what's going on. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen the photos on Everest where there are lineups of clients trying to get to the summit. But that scene is common now on all of the 8,000-meter peaks.
So the climbers then that gain recognition, that are widely considered the superstars, if you will, increasingly they're coming from this region. They're not necessarily Westerners flying in and making a name for themselves. So who are some of these new stars of climbing that are front and center in the media coverage, and again, not just anonymous Sherpas in a journal somewhere?
Again, I think that the internet is changing the way local climbers are being recognized as well. It used to be that it was foreign climbers who were the stars. It was the Italians on K2. Nowadays, the stars on 8,000-meter peaks are local climbers. It's Nims, it's Mingma Ji, it's Ali Sadpara, Dawa Yangsam. These are the superstars of the high-altitude climbing world today.
And those superstars are just the tip of the ice axe, if you will, of a much larger ecosystem of climbers. What is the current state of some of these high alpine regions in Pakistan and Nepal? Has climbing transformed the economy? Have some of these, frankly, quite poor villages seen a real transformation as a result of the wealth that high altitude climbing has brought to their region?
One of the things that interested me the most about researching this area and this activity was to see the trickle-down effect. So we have the superstars at the top who own the companies, who are bringing the clients because of their status. And then you have the next level down, all of the workers who are still guiding, breaking trail, carrying loads, building camps, cooking. These people are working in the mountains for the same reason that they've always worked in the mountains, and that is to earn enough money to educate their kids.
That was Monocle's Seattle correspondent, Gregory Scruggs, and he was there speaking to the Canadian author, who is Bernadette MacDonald. Now, mountains in the Himalayas, but Rocky Mountains, Rocky Mountain Blue, like other country songs with mountains in them. I'm sure there are a lot, aren't there?
Oh, there are a lot when it comes to mountains and broken hearts and relations with nature, you know, whether it's animals or they come with cowboys. And I mentioned to earlier, by marriage, my wife comes from the Wild West. They have even in Cheyenne, Wyoming, they have even the Western Museum. So, and once a year, they hold Frontier Days, which is the second biggest rodeo in the world, between the rodeo and the country music. And it's a lot about, you know, the relation of living in the beautiful landscape, but also sometimes in isolation and driving long distances and a lot of broken hearts.
A lot of broken hearts. And of course, one of the reasons this is front and center of our consciousness right now is Beyoncé and her Cowboy Carter album, where she has basically taken this whole kind of Western or country music thing and reclaimed it for herself and taken it back to its roots, if you like, because we view cowboy culture as very right, very macho, very right wing. Type of image is what's been projected onto it. But she's saying, actually, there was a time before.
Correct. And she's right. Historically, and you forget that a lot of the ranches, a lot of slavery until the Civil War. So many of the people that actually did the work on these big ranches were black slaves. And I think so she reclaims it. And a lot of it is important because the culture right now is very white, very male. And if you go, to the concerts like in Frontier Days, it's mainly white. Mm. And I think that's a great contribution, Beyoncé. And because is her fame and the influence she is in American culture, she can do that.
Yeah, but I mean, there's some kind of pushback because there she is posing with what's basically the Confederate flag. I mean, there's a lot. There are problematic themes in there for a lot of people. I was thinking back to Sarah Churchwell's book, which is The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells. Just going back into that kind of culture and how at one point, I mean, everybody's favorite book. You all read it when you're 16. You love Margaret Mitchell, but. One step further in terms of looking at American history through a different lens. I was interviewing Viet Thanh Nguyen, who's the Vietnamese-American Pulitzer Prize-winning author last week, and he pointed out that all over the world, Cowboys and Indians is a game that children play, which is basically very early American propaganda for saying it's okay to kill brown people.
Correct. And when you mention it, there is the celebration, Jewish celebration of Purim, which is basically dressing up for Purim. And I remember probably the age of four or something, I was dressed up as a cowboy. Never think that I will actually go and visit cowboy land.
Or marry one.
or marry someone from there. And yes, this is one of the things. And, watching TV series like Bonanza, it was all very clear, and it's very clear who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And it's a narrative that evolved throughout, culture. And when you have Hollywood behind you and the money that comes with that, you can dictate the culture, you can dictate the narrative, and they dictated it in a way that obviously, the pioneers came only to do good. It was a mission from God, going back to the building a city upon a hill, the eyes of the world upon you. As a certain Mr. Winthrop put it,
yes,
when he landed in the Bay of Massachusetts back in the 17th century. And this is a white narrative. And obviously now we see, and rightly so, the counter narrative. No, it's not exactly like this. And this was involved dispossessing and the killing of many other people that indigenous to this place, which is not only there, it's in Australia, in other places. So basically telling the historical story there in a way that is more accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the other thing it's doing, or particularly Beyoncé is doing here, is influencing fashion. And this is what The Guardian picks up on, talking about the Beyoncé effect, puts Levi's on the fashion hot list.
I know. Again, if you go to this place, jeans is what, denim is what you wear. And definitely, and she brought the idea of kind of denim on denim on denim. So you can wear a shirt, trousers, and even a handbag, which is all denim, which is more a fashion. That was the way that it was worn back in the 19th century. Levi's, Wrangler, and the other famous brands. But again, when Beyoncé talks about or sings about Levi's jeans, then you have 20% rise in sale and their stocks and shares go up. So you see also the power of popular culture. But at the end of the day, when you are in these parts of the world, jeans is what you wear for work, and your nicer jeans is when you have a special occasion. But that's about it when it comes to fashion.
And I know you've got a relative who has a special occasion pair of jeans.
He does, because when I told you the story, we came for my sister-in-law's wedding. He had to drive from the middle of the mountains in Colorado for 5-6 hours. So I'm waiting for him to come. And, you know, I have a shower and said, yeah, I need a shower and I'll go and change. And he was in jeans, cowboy boots, cowboy hat, and a checkered flannel shirt. Half an hour later, he came out and he wore cowboy boots, jeans, checkered shirt, and a cowboy hat, and said, you look very similar, and said, no, but this is my dress one for the wedding.
Yossi, thank you very much indeed. That's all we've got time for on this edition of Monocle on Saturday. Thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. And Monocle on Saturday returns next weekend. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.